The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns, Gear, and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And after that, I dropped a GPU-12 at the same position. Remember, it was my first live delivery, if you could say so. I remember being, you know, I was sweating like hell afterwards and transmitting to my wing, hey, it's very hot today. I said, okay, well, you're sitting in the same cockpit as you do with the same air condition, so I guess it's just, you're just psyched up.
Yeah.
But it was like the experience of, you know, extreme clarity. You were like, you're just there at in this moment. You didn't think about what happened 30 seconds ago, and you didn't think about what's going to happen in next 3 or 5 minutes. You were just there, and subconsciously was doing all the right things with your muscle memory was running around, and the checklist was just, you know, the outcome of training and training and training and training. Just, it was fun afterwards to see, okay, how did that work in the real world?
Tower to my stretches, release you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Seat tied, Altera 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire projector, close me, fire projector, hey. On my program, curveballs at 354.
Turn in, lights on.
Next day, thank you. 16, 15,000, RV single data.
Whatever one target.
Matt, thanks for joining me on the podcast. I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day. We got a lot to talk about today. You got quite a storied career. I'm just going to hit a couple little highlights, and then I'm going to hand the talking stick over to you. But you first flew the F-16 in 1993, over 4,000 hours in the Viper so far, 100 combat missions. You participated in Operation Enduring Freedom, Unified Protector, Inherent Resolve, and I'm missing Allied Force, right? So,
correct.
A lot to kind of dig in here, but that's the surface level from me. Can you give me the 60 to 90 second kind of elevator pitch of who you are, a little bit of your background, and we'll dive into it?
Yeah, well, I'm obviously a Danish fighter pilot who's been flying pretty much for 30 years.
Yeah,
been in all the F-16 squadrons that are in the Danish Air Force, which it's not four anymore, but we're down to one or maybe two. And it's, you know, the record just pretty much says in short terms that I'm an old guy.
Fair enough. Well, you say the squadrons are paring down, but the Danish Air Force has accepted its first F-35, if not two?
Yeah, you know, I kind of joined right after the Cold War stopped pretty much. So we were still geared for... if you know Soviet invasion or Warsaw Pact stuff. And when I joined the Air Force, we had more than I guess, 100 combat aircraft in Denmark.
Okay.
And Denmark is a small country. And it was about six squadrons. We had four F-16 squadrons, and we had two with the F-35 Dragon, which was a Swedish fighter bomber, and not the F-35 we know today.
Right.
So it was kind of... armed or, you know, Air Force, which was ready for some kind of war of attrition. And then after the meltdown on the east side of the Iron Curtain, it started to change things in Denmark or pretty much every NATO country, I guess. And we cut all the F-35 Dragon squadrons, the two squadrons there. So we had four F-16 squadrons in the beginning of the 90s.
Okay.
And we had two in a base up north called Aalborg, and two south in Skrydstrup. And after, I think in 2001, we shot down one squadron in Aalborg, and 2005 we shot down the second squadron, and then we only had the two squadrons in Skrydstrup. And then a few years ago, we kind of cut one of the squadrons and made a bigger size squadrons, which was what we were gonna transform into the F-35 Lightning II squadron.
Okay.
But now again, things are kind of changing, and you know, I think everybody in on the western side is starting to look at what we kind of are missing. If we should be able to have a war of attrition again.
Interesting, because I can see after the Iron Curtain fell, as you kind of alluded to, then the war of attrition, or you know, the hordes coming across the gates, not necessarily so much of a threat, but still being a NATO country, I imagine that's probably the big draw for all these operations, Allied Force, Unified Protector, Inherent Resolve, Enduring Freedom, etc. What's the like the temperament, or can you put your thumb on the pulse for Denmark and kind of the, I guess, aptitude, the willingness to participate in a lot of these, like the, and we talk like actually, you know, the society itself.
Yeah, I think what happened was that, of course, we should be able to defend our own country during the Cold War. And when the Iron Curtain disappeared, we were looking for what are we supposed to do with the Air Force? So we were transforming it into like an expeditionary Air Force, being able to go outside our country borders and pretty much do stuff with the U.S. Air Force, right, or the United States whenever it was kind of needed. So it was kind of a transition, you know, where I was doing what I was doing to protect my country for, you know, God and King and country, and suddenly it was another game. There should be another reason for me to do what I was supposed to do. So now it was like you know, I was doing this for a better world. I hoped so, at least. So that kind of a change in the perspective of being a pilot in the Air Force.
Yeah, interesting. We can chat a little bit more about that too as we go on, but I want to jump back to the beginning. So you initially enlisted in the Army. Can you talk to me, like, what was the impetus? What drove you, wanted to join and kind of go down this path, and obviously going from the Army to the Air Force? There's some talk there.
Yeah, it was like, of course I saw Top Gun when I was in gymnasium at that time, but you know, I also found Air Force interesting, but at that time, I think the contract length was like 10 years, and for me, it was the rest of my life. I mean, I was just, I couldn't jump into that.
Right.
But I thought about going into the Army as a reserve officer. My dad had done that, so if he could, I should be able to do that too, I thought. And it was like a two-year where you were first being educated to become a sergeant and then a first lieutenant. And then you had like 1 year educating soldiers in a platoon. And I think, I mean, I was scared death the first month in the Army, of course. Total transition from this civilian life, where my biggest concern was to being able to breathe. That was pretty much the only thing I should take care of myself. And then coming into the Army and, you know, demands from morning to late evening and being tired, being pushed around and stuff. But after a while, you found out that, well, it wasn't that bad. It was doable. And I remember in I was about to be finished with my two-year period, and I saw this poster saying become a pilot in the Air Force. I kind of looked at it and said, okay, that looked pretty cool. That dude had some nice sunglasses on, sitting there in
big watch
in that, yeah, exactly, in that cockpit. So I might phone that number so I don't regret it when I become an old man sitting there and saying, why did I never try to get into to the Air Force as a pilot. So I was kind of like coincidence or like just going with stream, I guess. So it's never been my, you know, the biggest desire in my life to become a pilot. I think it was just average, like a lot of other young guys at that time. So, but I mean, I'm so glad, and I just found my path, and it's I never ever looked back for a single moment.
Interesting, because, you know, that time period, so 91, 92, you know, the U.S. Air Force is kind of going through a drawdown, because obviously you wrapped up the Cold War and then Desert Storm, and then a lot of guys are still going through pilot training, but they end up getting banked, so they send them off to random staff jobs, or they just get cut loose altogether. So was in that time period, was it really competitive? Was there really any change? Were there any dynamics going on? I mean,
I think in the Danish Air Force, I think we had the greatest amount of young people who want to become pilots. I think it must have been one of the largest amount of young guys want to go into the Air Force at that time. And I do remember being at Shepherd that I think they only had one fighter guy on my 9305, and I think the rest was banked fighters or tankers or C5s or whatever. But in Denmark we were not we had like we were extremely vulnerable to the infrastructure in commercial airlines. Pretty much when they needed pilots, they were taking everybody from the Air Force, and then it took like 5, 6, 7 years before they needed pilots again, and then we blew up. Right. So in fact, when I started, I came into the squadron, we were pretty much 4 full squadrons flying F-16 in Denmark. And you know, when commercial airlines again opened up, it was about 96, 97, we were like 4 or 5 pilots in each squadron. It was like you had 2, 3, 4 aircraft per pilot. So that's that was kind of crazy.
That's a wild problem.
It is.
I've talked about on the podcast that, you know, our Air Force is still going through this pendulum swing. Airlines hire, people are getting out. All sorts of dynamics go into it. But it is interesting to hear that, because imagine, so if you have 100 jets, you're probably, 25 to 35 pilots per squadron, maybe 40, is probably what the healthy number would be, or is that a fair statement?
I think at that time we were probably, around 18, 20 pilots per squadron.
Okay.
And then when commercial airlines opened up, 96, 97, like, so I was pretty young. I was the youngest guy in the squadron pretty much. And but went to like straight into a captain position, because we were nobody left in the squadron.
Yeah. How much were you flying then? If you had that many jets,
all the time.
Yeah.
Just 3 times a day sometimes. You know, like it was like 200 hours a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
I imagine too, you're probably doing a lot of BFM.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
we had the old Block 10 and Block 15 F-16s, and at that time we only had heaters as Sidewinder missiles, the Lima and November models. So it was no AMRAAMs, no Sparrow, no nothing. So it was like you had to do BFM all the day. So it was like 1v1 or 2v2 ACM. No beyond visual range, and that was half the time. The other half was air to ground with the DOM bombs and rockets. No target pod, no lasing, no nothing. So it was a lot of turning and burning, and it was like your skills for flying was like the main factor for you to become a good pilot at the time. Not like today, where you really have to be a good system operator also.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective, because I think maybe a lot of people don't realize just, from what the F-16 was, your day VFR fighter, and then how it's evolved into these complex mission sets, long range fights, air to air.
Exactly.
doing C, D, all these different things, and even like cruise missile intercepts as the just thing. Yeah. So you really, I think flying the F-16 is easy. Operating all the systems and managing the formation and the tactics, that's the hard part. But when you're going out there and just doing BFM, it's mano v mano, you know, to go out there and see who can get around the circle fast enough.
Yeah, exactly.
And get in the ways.
Yeah, we were getting pretty good at it at that time, flying all that BFM and ACM. Compared to, I mean, today we might fly it 4, 5, 6 times a year. At that time, we were flying it 4, 5, 6 times a week, maybe, yeah. But 2 weeks.
Well, I think it's important to point out too. So I said 4,000 hours in the beginning, but if you now, I mean, a lot of my hours are 7 hours at a pop, orbiting in a circle, doing close air support and things like that, or pond crossings. But 4,000 hours for you, there's probably a lot of up and down the ladder time, a lot of starts.
Yeah, there is, but still, you know, when we go on international operations, I have those 7-hour missions too, and I know that drill. Loitering around, waiting for something to happen.
Every now and then it does.
Yeah.
So the transition to the Air Force, you called the number, you get picked up, and then you go to NJP, Euro-NATO Joint Jet Pilot Training, out in Shepherd, Texas. Can you talk to me a little bit about that experience and how was it like going through that?
Yeah, it was a great experience. I mean, it was first time for me to be really away from home, and together with we, of course, American guys, and we had British guys and Belgium and German guys in my flight. And it was, I mean, you had to climb this huge mountain, and you didn't know what it really looked like, and it was just a great challenge, and extremely positive experience for me to go through Shepherd. It's damn hard work, you know.
Yeah,
I had that kind of attitude when I began, saying, okay, you might not have the skills. It might be where my dreams of become a pilot stops, but it should be like, if it happens, I should be able to look at myself in the mirror and say, okay, you did everything you could. And I could have been to Duffy's a bit more and drinking some more beers in the beginning. But I was studying pretty hard at that time.
Well, and I think to go from Denmark, or really anywhere in Europe, to Wichita Falls, Texas, that's a quite a polar opposite place, especially probably back in the early 90s. You're not connected, you know, via FaceTime and things like that. So you really kind of, I would imagine, plopped out of your comfort zone big time.
Yeah. But the good thing is that the other guys were at the same place as I was. So you were not alone on that account. But it was a big change, really. And also, I mean, you also proved to yourself that you were able to handle that on your own. So it was good in a lot of ways, I think, for me as it's just personal development.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Did you do F-16 training back home, or did you do it in the United States?
Yes, we did. We did it in country at that time.
Okay.
And I was pretty. I'm from another part of Denmark than Jutland, where we have the Air Force bases. And I didn't really care if I was going to Aalborg or to Skrydstrup to fly F-16, but I came to Aalborg, and it was I was pretty glad because there's a kind of difference in how it is orchestrated. In Aalborg, pretty much all the pilots live close together, but in Skrydstrup they are split pretty far apart. So
okay.
the social life. The brotherhood, the come together after work stuff. It was world class in Aalborg, pretty much. To be humble about that. It's hard to be humble about it. Sorry. So I came there, and we were five guys coming from Shepherd, starting the conversion, and it's the flying stuff has been pretty good for me in in Egypt. I busted one ride, though. It was prior to T37 solo, the solo checkout, and I was flying in the patterns with my IP there and making one excellent landing after another. And then about to make the last landing, and was it CUDA it was called, I think, coming up on the frequency saying, hey, final go around, no gear. Oh, man. So I had to try to convince my IP on the next ride that I was good enough for... But I think what happened was that he was thinking, okay, Matt, he's pretty good at what he's doing. So it's a good student that kills you. Complacency there. He shouldn't have let me left the perch, I guess, with no gear. But anyway,
yeah.
So the flying stuff was pretty good for me at in Japan coming back. You know, you had the short transition where you have to fly formation, instrument, start landing stuff, all the basic, and then flying should be, I mean, secondary for you. Now you should be able to use the aircraft as a weapon platform. And it was, as we talked about earlier, kind of basic, the air-to-air, since you only had the gun and you had a heat-seeking missile. And again, the air-to-ground, it was dawn bombs and rockets. So the spectrum was a little bit more narrow than it is today concerning, you know, the different disciplines you could fly.
Yeah, I think now you consider those all part task trainers, basically the blocking and tackling to build the airmanship and then move on to the next phase is really doing the complex stuff we have going on today.
But anyway, it was a lot of flying. I mean, you as we talked about earlier, you have to, I mean, be able to fly that aircraft damn good to have success in the air. And I think the conversion was fine. I was starting to feel okay. This is the right place for me to be. And after 1 year, you come out to the squadron, and it was kind of a big change, I think, because you've been evaluated on everything you've done for the last, I don't know how many years. And now you go to the squadron of flight. And of course, you're still being evaluated because we were looking at the 20-minute Betamax video tape, I guess we could. That was the information you'd pick out after a flight. But then the guys who have been IPs for me were suddenly, buddies in the squadron. And I remember once at a debriefing where this early instructor pilot was my flight lead, and we had been fighting some Norwegian F-16s and came back for the debriefing, and I was tumbleweed right after takeoff pretty much. But my instructor pilot was standing there and saying, okay, at this point I lose SA and don't know where the Norwegian fighters are. I was like, holy crap. How can he, I mean, he was a kind of a guard for me, stand there and say he lost SA on, just, you know, here's my limits.
Right.
But I mean, after a few seconds, pretty much, I found, okay, that is cool. To be there amongst the best of the best and just admit when you're doing something wrong or when your limits is, this is how far you can go and stuff. So, That was foundation for like a really, a learning environment that I didn't really expect that prior to getting into a squadron. I thought again it was like, okay, who's the biggest and tallest and fastest stuff, but it was like something totally different that what I would have experienced or expected at that time.
Yeah, talk about it's a profound moment, and I've talked about that too. Is the like there's no rank in the debrief?
Exactly.
It could be the boss who's messing up. Obviously, you'd be respectful, but that's how you learn. And
exactly
by not having the ego comes off, and let's really whittle down what's going on here and what went wrong, so that we can all be better.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of institutions that could learn something from us about that debriefing concept there.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's impressive how that developed over time and how it's permeated across our air forces? Because I'm sure you've done some exercises with non-Western, non-NATO countries where that is not the case. Yeah. Sitting in the shot valve, and clearly they're calling shots into blue players, and then they start speaking secure in their own language, and then, no, that shot didn't happen, you know, rather than owning it and fessing up so that you know, everyone can learn and be better. So
But that's the fun part. When you have the experience, you know, okay, those guys are the good guys. I want to go to war with those guys. But those guys,
we're going to keep them just over here a watchful eye on them.
Exactly.
Yeah, the coalition stuff gets pretty interesting, to say the least. Which I would like dig into your experience with that. But before we do that, I've only touched an F-16 in Europe once. I've landed there. I fly across Europe all the time now. Really busy airspace. But can you talk to me a little bit about some of the complexities or challenges? And it could be, like, in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, in the U.S., there's a 10,000-foot runway, you know, every 50-100 miles, you know? So I always have, like, a divert option. A lot of military fields with cables. I know you're probably using drogue shoots. Can you talk to me, like, and now I know it's second nature, but what are some of the challenges and complexities that I might not be thinking about?
Yeah, in fact, we don't have drogue shoots. The Norwegians had that on their F-16s, but when I began flying in Denmark, I could take off and be in contact with the tower, and I was passing 3,500 feet. I could say goodbye, tower. And I didn't have to talk to anybody climbing up to 50,000 feet.
That's amazing. Yeah.
We in Denmark, we had like a totally unique airspace, which we don't have anymore. Or it's now can go up to 19,500 feet.
Okay.
And then I had to be in contact with somebody flying above. But at that time, it was like, I mean, you owned the sky pretty much. And we were flying, without Link 16, and it was like, well, we didn't have the world's best SA maybe. So I can't remember when it changed, but it kind of makes sense to make more strict rules when you get up into airline airspace too. But we do have like quite a few airfields we can use in Denmark as divert airfields. So that is not like Europe is pretty tense concerning airfields for diverts and stuff, but the airspace gets worse when you get down to Germany or Belgium. Flying a TLP, I did that out of Belgium. It was like, you know, you had this little square of airspace, and then you had this, and it was like a hell flying air to air in Europe at that time.
It's really busy and congested down there for sure.
Yeah,
is there a lot of inter-nation working? Like, you know, you said you fought the Norwegians, et cetera, or is it that just kind of limited to exercises or kind of big moments, if you will?
I mean, in the old days, we could kind of grab the phone and call the Norwegians, say, "Hey, you want to play today?"
Yeah,
and we could do the same with the Dutch. But today it's more like it's mostly exercises, you know. Okay. It's like if we go and play with the British guys and we got aircraft breaking down, it'll spoil the next 14 days of training if we are missing one or two aircraft and stuff. So it's more in connection with the exercises that we are training with foreign countries' air forces.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. I want to jump to, I guess, Allied Force, because that was your first named operation, if I'm correct.
It's correct, yeah.
Can you talk to me a little bit about that time period and what was going
on? Yeah, it was the end of the 90s, and there were Yugoslavia was breaking up and had a lot of turmoil down there. And for me going down, we were... At that time, we were converted to midlife update F-16s in Aalborg. And Skrydstrup was the old legacy F-16. And going to Italy, Grazinese, north of Naples. And it was the first time the Air Force kind of was going into war. So it was like going to this Italian base with starfighters together, some Norwegians, they were there too. And we were living at a hotel near the coastline, Mediterranean. A few, Hesco Bastion, but maybe a little bit of barbed wire and stuff.
Yeah.
So what kind of, okay, is this really how it's supposed to be? And for me, going down there, it was, I had a hard time seeing who is really the bad guy, you know. I think all of them kind of had a small competition going of who could do the most cruel things to mankind, pretty much. So I was not like, having this, okay, we are definitely fighting the right war. Anyway.
Yeah.
Since it was like the first time we were going anywhere, I think on the political side, it was okay, this might be some nasty stuff or whatever. So the only thing we were flying was air defense, combat air patrols around Serbia. And we had, I think we were having laser-guided bombs, but we didn't have any target pods. So if we were going to drop a laser-guided bomb, it should be laced in by maybe a British tornado or whatever. And if that bomb didn't hit, was that Danish responsibility or a UK responsibility? I think there was a lot of thoughts going on there. So pretty much only flying a defensive counter air. And we didn't have any engagement with anybody at that time. But that was the first time for me flying those long missions, you know, being on station for 3-4 hours, air fueling 3-5 times and back and forth. So it, often the you know, the biggest enemy is to stay awake on those missions.
That's,
yeah, it, it's, and it's, it can be a battle. We don't have any uppers or downers or anything.
Man.
So yeah. But then in the end of the conflict, we had like 2 missions or something like that with aircraft from Skrydstrup, you know, the legacy F-16 with no GPS or anything, flying in and dropping some dump bombs on a target, in the middle of nowhere, I guess. So it was like, you know, what is war about? And, you know, flying around, coming back at the base, going to the hotel, jumping in the pool, asking for a pina colada. Is this really how war is supposed to be? But anyway, it was like, it was a political level, on an Air Force level, on a pilot level. It was like the first time we really were going out to see what is all this about, to the war thing, you know.
You mentioned the midlife upgrade, the MLU. Can you talk to me, what did that bring to the F-16 versus what you were flying previous blocks? Or
it was bringing everything, you know, just GPS. We had the old ring laser gyro thing. Was okay, like drifting a mile in per hour or something. I mean, yes. where the diamond was standing in the hot, you were damn sure it wasn't the target.
Right.
We had to do those, what's it called, a visual reference point, I guess, where you were slewing the nav platform within a few minutes of your TOT, just to be sure that it was around or situated around the target you had. So we didn't have any night vision goggles. We couldn't drop JDAMs, I think.
Okay.
Due to the wiring system in the wings and stuff. And we had like, we only had a radar scope in the aircraft. We didn't have any multifunction displays or anything. So, you know, you were it was like a P-51 Mustang with a bigger engine, pretty much, flying around that, but still the same airframe, of course. But then getting the MLU, you got the options for AMRAMs, you got the options for JDAMs, for later on we got the target pod also. So and the multifunction displays, of course. So SA wise, I mean, sometimes it's good not to have any SA, knowing how dangerous things are. But that was
ignorance is bliss.
Huge jump going to a midlife update for us. Yeah.
And so when you're flying the caps, I know you mentioned you obviously didn't. Nodane dropped a GBU-12 or a laser guided bomb during that employment. When you're doing the caps, though, did you pretty much, I guess, write that off? And then it's just sitting out there with. Did you have? I assume you had AMRAAM since you're doing that. You had the MLU.
Yeah, we did.
Okay.
We did, yeah.
And that's the ROE piece. That's something again too that, you know, really going down the rabbit hole. And I think this would lead into Enduring Freedom. Be a good discussion.
Yeah.
Just because the ROEs, I remember reading through those, like every nation has their set of ROEs. I felt with Inherent Resolve, it was a little more blended. That's probably not the right term. They're probably more parallel. Everyone, especially in the early days, with the exception of probably going into Syria, everyone's doing the same thing. But Enduring Freedom had evolved so much that every country really had specific rules as far as what they could do.
Exactly. I can't really remember in the beginning, but definitely.
Are you a passionate aviation enthusiast? Then you'll be thrilled to hear about our sponsor, Aircore Aviation. This exciting company has been revolutionizing the aviation industry since 2008, and they have some amazing career opportunities available. More about that in just a minute. Aircore Aviation is at the forefront of airworthiness of legacy aircraft dating all the way back to World War II. Their dedicated team is involved in various aspects of aerospace, including manufacturing, fabrication, restoration, and support, using state-of-the-art technology. Their exceptional expertise in core manufacturing capabilities like metal forming, CNC machining, and complete aircraft rebuilding has led to the restoration of some award-winning aircraft, such as a couple P-51s, such as P-51 Thunderbird, Twilight Tier, and Sierra Sioux 2. And if you've been following me for a while, you might remember I was fortunate enough to fly over the Super Bowl in 2018 in Minneapolis. The formation was led by Sierra Sioux 2 alongside two A-10s and myself in the F-16, so this is a very cool full circle experience. These incredible achievements have captured the attention of aircraft owners, aviation enthusiasts, and the general public alike. If you've always dreamt of a career in aviation, then Aircore Aviation is the perfect place for you. They are rapidly expanding their team in 2024 and have job openings in departments such as engineering and CAD, quality assurance, fabrication, and restoration. This is your chance to turn a passion into a profession. Aircore Aviation is offering some amazing benefits for full-time positions, including health insurance, PTO, HSA, retirement plans, life insurance, and the extra perk of enjoying Fridays off. If you're ready to be part of a team dedicated to fulfilling the dreams through the preservation of historical aircraft, visit aircoreaviation.com/careers today and take the first step towards an exciting career in aviation. Again, that's aircoreaviation.com/careers. Don't miss out on this incredible opportunity.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Enduring Freedom, for example, when we Afghanistan, we had like a totally clear political statement that we were not allowed to cross the Pakistan border. I mean, nobody really knew where that border was, or there were five different versions of that border, and it could be kind of frustrating being in that area where a lot of everything pretty much went on in that border area or region. And then it's the Danish jets, well, we'll just call for some A-10 from background. You know, being there, you could all see the smoke from the troubles down there. But I think that was the, you know, on the Danish side, the political, getting used to what is this about and how do we want to, we're getting more and more used to being a nation in war, you know, as time goes here. So, and then again, a huge difference going to Libya. I mean, we could do compared to the two previous international operations in Libya, we were at the same sheet of music as United States of America, I think.
Yeah, we jumped over and during Freedom, but Libya, you guys were operating out of Sigonella, is that?
Yeah, we were.
And then, so I guess maybe it'd be a good compare and contrast, like your enduring freedom time to Libya. Granted, two different nations, two vastly different conflicts, but just if you can talk to me a little bit about your experiences with both and like maybe what the day in the life of is like, anything that stands out.
I think, you know, past 9/11, or I mean, everything was turned upside down at that point. Everybody, you know, time stood still when this squadron mate came into the big briefing room saying, hey, somebody flew into the towers and stuff. And the first thought was, okay, we are going to war. And it was like, okay, for me, it was, this is a just case. I mean, it might be spelled Al-Qaeda or Taliban. Well, it looks the same, you know. So I think we were doing the right thing here. And we went to Manas Air Base with the Norwegians and the Dutch F-16 were flying out of there. And there were no pina colada, no swimming pool, you know. So it was more Hesco Bastion and watchtowers and guards and stuff. So it was more like what you would expect when you go to war. And of course, we had some very long missions also out there. I remember we had like, I think there were 20 minutes between Osh and Dushanbe where you couldn't reach any radio station on the ground. It was just pitch dark, mountains, and nothing else but stars and you when you're flying there with your wingman and getting into Afghanistan. And then again, it was, when I think about it, it was a lot of loitering time. You know, again, fatigue being the biggest enemy, pretty much. I experienced one in a racetrack with the tanker. You know, we're just turning south, and then I wake up inside Pakistan, pretty much, and the tanker is heading north again, turning around and eating those. We could eat some coffin pills, and it didn't work at all when I was flying. I came down, was awake for 36 hours and sick like 2 days after that. So, those long missions, they can kill you, really. Yeah. And we would hope or beg and do anything we could to get some uppers and downers we could use when we were having that crisis in the cockpit.
Yeah. I had one specific sortie. It was in northern Syria, and it was a crypto changeover day. And so we get up there, and it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and we cannot talk to anyone. It is just static the entire time. And I that was the first time I took a go pill. But I was like, I am not going to make it. I am literally falling asleep in the jet. And I think, you know, there's obviously a line where you got to be careful with those things. But they really can save your butt when...
And I think
sleep cycle, whatever it might be, yeah.
And if the hour is that if you take it, then go back, land, and then get detoxed, and when doc says okay, you're ready again, you can go fly again. Just have a procedure for that.
Yeah, and like ours was pretty. We had a document when we did it. You know, you had two pills that you were allowed to carry at a time. So obviously, if you're going back for more constantly, like it would throw up a red flag. But I mean, those things. Definitely a glove save when you're just.
Yeah. But we had a formation flying, came back to Manas, and it was, we could land, bad weather, had to go back to Bagram. And the first guy, he lands a pretty heavyweight after air refueling, and it's wet, and he goes off the runway. In fact, into a minefield, ejects, but survives.
Did he land in the minefield?
No, he went off the minefield or off the runway into the minefield. It wasn't been cleared for mines at least. So
yeah, right.
And the wingman, he was just loitering, and he was getting so tired, so he was like almost saying, okay, am I deject? I mean, I'm not able to. I mean, I can't go with the air refueling assets to. I can't remember. They were flying out of the Indian Ocean somewhere, I guess.
Oh, down to like Alud or something.
Yeah, I think so. Ooh. And then finally they get the runway cleared and he can land. I think he was flying 12 hours. So, yeah. And he, I mean, a coffee pill.
Yeah.
That's not going to save you.
Hey, thanks for nothing.
Yeah, thanks for nothing.
Oh, yeah. What time period was that? Was that right after things kicked off?
We were there from October 2002. So a year after kickoff, pretty much. And then I think October 2003, we were going back from there. So, but that was like, that was more like you were a part of the big team, I guess, in it together and feeling and hoping that you could change something down there. But it was like, I think we were dropping like 16 bombs. I was the one in the first, if you can say, the hot close air support engagement. I was like, you know, when you're flying all those missions with search and you have to look for something and loiter and air fuel bag and nothing really happening. And then came in north of, Kandahar, I think, somewhere. And you have like, I think, a Reaper flying around underneath you, and there's a B1 above you. Okay, it's showtime today. So I remember talking to the forward air controller, and he might have had a little higher pitch than you're used to when you're doing training missions back home, and you can hear the M60 machine gun shooting in the background. And, you know, okay, it was kind of tense. And initially, I was asked to go down and do a strafe. I think, fine, okay. But back in Denmark, we only trained low angle strafe between 5 and 15 degrees at that time. But here there's mountains and stuff. So, okay, I think I'll dive down. That's about, okay, that's 25 degrees and shoot. And, you know, at a way longer distance than you're used to. So I remember pulling the trigger and see, oh, you missed the target. There they were, you know, on the way up. So that was kind of interesting to do the improvisation on the run, so to speak. And after that, I dropped a GPU-12 at the same position. Remember, it was my first live delivery, if you could say so. I remember being, you know, I was sweating like hell afterwards, and transmitting to my wing, hey, it's very hot today. And say, okay, well, you're sitting in the same cockpit as you do with the same air condition, so I guess it's just you're just psyched up. But it was like the experience of you know, extreme clarity. You were like, you're just there at in this moment. You didn't think about what happened 30 seconds ago, and you didn't think about what's going to happen in next 3 or 5 minutes. You was just there, and subconsciously was doing all the right things with your muscle memory was running around, and the checklist was just, you know, the outcome of training and training and training and training. Just, it was fun afterwards to see, okay, how did that work in the real world? So, and then it was kind of a relief also, I guess, to be able to do what was expected of me, what I expected of myself, probably my family expected of me, what the Air Force expected of me. So it was like kind of a relief to get that, okay, you can fill out that flight suit and do what the Air Force is paying you for.
So you mentioned this. I would like to probably paint the picture a little bit more, because listen, all you train to is low angle strafe, 5 to 15 degrees. And then, you know, for those listening, like thinking about like now basically improvising, like 25 degrees nose low when you're not used to doing it, turning the chainsaw on, is a very different thing, especially if you've never have done that. I mean, the ranges are different. The sight picture is incredibly different. And too, you know, just thinking the speeds, you know, with the flight controls of the F-16, typically, I don't know, doing high angle strafe, 350 knots rolling in by the time you're rolling down the chute, depending on how fast you get going. I think it was at 450 when the logic changes with the rudder. I can't remember, you know, and so lot going on there. And I don't want you to just gloss over that because that's a big deal.
There was so much going on. So it was first when I came back and landed at MLS that I realized that I, on the pull out from the strafing, you know, looking for where the bullets hit. You missed the target. There were. Yeah. I was overgeeing the aircraft. I was just so psyched up, you know. Normally, you can feel G's. I mean, I don't have to look at the G meter to say, okay, this is 4, this is 5 G's. But psyched up, the adrenaline was just running through your veins. And it might have felt like 4 G's, but obviously it was a little bit too much. So, but anyway, the GPU 12 still worked.
Yeah, turns out just fine. In this time period too, so 2001, 2006, you're the head of operations of the squadron. Is that equivalent to like what we say a squadron commander, or is that like a director of ops, or how does that kind of
a director of ops, you know, taking care of pilots, of the training, of scheduling, all that stuff.
Yeah, so you're doing that, you're the display pilot, and then also...
So that was like going, I think we had like normally a period of 3, 4, maybe 5 years, and the last one just went to Scandinavian Airlines System flying there, so...
Okay.
So I grabbed it, and you know, to fly a display is just, that's where you really learn to fly the aircraft, with the slowest speeds and the highest G's and all that stuff. So I really enjoyed it, you know, going to Britain, celebrating, was it 65 years of, since Battle of Britain, and was just, I was single at that time, so just touring Europe during the summer and stuff. So, yeah, no complaints. No complaints.
That's good.
Yeah.
I felt too, doing the display, like, that's when I could actually start telling the difference between different jets. Granted, you're flying the same thing over and over again, but then I could start noticing slight differences in the flight control system. A year into it doing that, which is kind of cool, I think, to then feel like you have that experience and that bound to have that little bit more of awareness. Now I wasn't doing anything tactical, so that's another story, but interesting. So there's the one deployment to Manas, and that's Kyrgyzstan for those who haven't been there. Beautiful during the summer, nice weather. I went through in February and then also again back in August. Yeah. February was my hell on earth. It was so cold and snow and ice. But
No shit.
Did you do one round to Kyrgyzstan?
I was three times. So almost 5 months in total. So I had like from October and then to like, I think last time was probably April. So I both had a bit of summer and a lot of winter.
Yeah.
But it was like, you know, flying out there, the air traffic control, you know, I remember, I think my third sortie going out of Afghanistan, we call Dushanbe control. And we were landing with like 8,000 pounds. So, okay, I light up the burner and check in with Dushanbe control. Dushanbe control, there's a fuck at Manas. Okay, thanks for that. That was probably the best call for those 5 months you gave me there. And we're going back and setting up a holding pattern. Yeah, the weather is getting better and stuff. And you got to see the divert field. Okay. They went away and the weather is good now, so you can come back. What kind of approach do you want to fly? Yeah, well, you just go in for an ILS, and you go into a final approach fix, and there's clouds below you. I think, okay, I'll fly this ILS, and you know, we have a steer point for the threshold. So select that and fly that ILS right down to that threshold, and you have nowhere else to go. There's no fuel for any diversion here. And I'm way below minimum. I was coming out at 50 or 100 feet. seeing no shit. No shit. And as I break the clouds, I can hear bum, 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 bum. I'm flying into a big flock of some kind of birds. landing. Yeah. Running down the runway, and I can hear my wingman. He's going around. Think, oh, man. But finally, he made one more shot and landed there. But thinking ATC, saying, yeah, you can choose whatever approach you want. You'll come in VFR. Well,
hey, yeah. Thanks.
No trust in them.
Well, you know, you hit your decision altitude, and then you get a few potatoes to process, so you're going to keep descending to make your decision. But 50 to 100 feet, man, just...
My plan was just to fly it like 13 AOA into the ground. Yeah. I mean, so...
Yeah, you got no other options. Yeah, like, no what, other I mean, options, yeah. It's a basket full of no fun. And,
yeah, exactly. Exactly. Just,
It is what it is.
Yeah.
And, yeah, those things present themselves from time to time. Talking to my buddies who are, you know, doing the exit of Afghanistan, you know, talk about no good options. You're flying over the country. I mean, you have options.
Exactly.
So that'll pop up from time to time.
Yeah.
We talked a little bit about Unified Protector and kind of those operations. I want to talk Inherent Resolve. When what was the role for you, Inherent Resolve? It was the tempo there.
Yeah, we were in Inherent Resolve. We were like, was it in 2015, I guess. And we were deployed to Kuwait, Al Jaba Air Base down there.
Okay.
And it was like, for me, it was like, you know, I was starting to get my doubt about what we were doing. I mean, we're giving the patient the same medicine and it doesn't work. You know, we've been removing bad guys and dictators and stuff. When I was flying in over Libya, I was thinking, in 3 years' time, I'll go down there on that beach with my family, telling those happy people that that bunker there is. I took that out. But I wasn't going to Libya. Libya was kind of chaotic. I mean, I think that the population probably would have been happier if Gaddafi was still there.
Yeah.
And flying over Iraq, which was just a mess. I mean, totally mess. And wondering again, I wonder if. Those people down there were more happy having the crazy dictator Saddam Hussein running the country. So I was kind of starting to lose faith in what we were doing. Not that, you know, I was doing my job totally professional and as I've done every time, but I think we were like, what are we doing? Kind of. So for me, it was more like, you know, in the beginning, Yugoslavia and Afghanistan, I was single at that time. Take me. I can take another tour and stuff. And then Libya, I had the twins. And they were about 4 years old at that time. And it was like, oh, now I can't just say, take me. I want to go with the guys because... I have two kids standing over here having, they want to have a dad and I want to be their dad. So it was more like, okay, when my number is picked, I'm going to go and do what I'm supposed to do. But I think maybe it's also like when you're getting older, you're reflecting more about what's going on and what you're doing. But I think it reminded me a lot about Afghanistan long missions over Iraq there. Maybe a bit more action than Afghanistan. But still, you know, sometimes you just... I think the big thing, a big difference is that you often fly in weather that you're not used to. I mean, I remember that was out of Sigonella. We were flying like it was thunder clouds from takeoff to landing. And we were just able to be in, 36,000 above the clouds. It was like huge light show. It was fascinating. And then your cabin pressure starts to run up and down. So, oh, man, if I had to go down through that, I would be toasted. And get down there, you're not able to see anything. You have to move the air refueling area to somewhere else where you can get used and come back again and down to Sigonella. And you, I was one of the last guys landing, and the first guys landing on that one was it's really slippery. Try to get out in the left side. There's a bit of braking action there, and you get down and hit the brakes, and nothing happens. And you try to go out to the left side, and the aircraft is kind of skidding sideways, and you're just fully down. And okay, I can't see how far. There was no runway markers at that runway, so I'm sitting there. I want to have the hook down, and it's night, so everything is blacked out. I have to take my right hand off the stick and my finger light. Okay, there's the hook, and hit the cable, and being drawn back up with the hook, and in, and it's off. That's another day. And the same we saw there in Q8, where you're landing in a snowstorm, or a sandstorm, sorry. Can't see shit, but okay, it's down there somewhere. Okay, I got the threshold, you know. Fly down there and hit it, and it should work.
I don't know about you. Probably the top five heart rate peaks for me, probably ever, is all revolved around landing. It's probably usually either really bad weather, or like you described, you go ahead and hit the brakes. Like you've already dropped the nose, yeah. You've hit the brakes, and then nothing happens. And you're like, this is not where I want to be right now. We're back up. You struck a chord. So I'm wondering the sentiment amongst you and your peers and the conversation, because I think there's probably some similarity. I was actually having a conversation with a buddy this weekend, and it's along the same long lines. I think, you know, going into Afghanistan, it was like, let's go get them, right? Like, let's make the world a better place. And then as this, you know, as the carousel goes around and around and around, and it really wasn't until we left Afghanistan was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. Like, we all knew it was going to end this way. But then you kind of have a realization. Maybe it's because you're getting older, or it's kind of like,
I think I remember sitting in the chow hall at Manas Air Base and hearing, okay, now Iraq is being invaded. It's like, damn. Now you know that so many resources are going to be pulled out of of your theater. So it's like, And then, okay, it went, down the drain pretty much.
Yeah, and I think my thing is, it's Humpty Dumpty. It fell off the wall, but like, there's no putting Humpty Dumpty back together again.
Nope. I do agree.
And I think for us in the U.S., we have a lot of issues with our southern border and people flowing across the southern border. But, you know, in November, I think they snagged 30 Iranians, three of which were on the terror watch list.
Okay.
So we have a very porous southern border that, now the problem set, in my opinion, at some point something bad is going to happen again, unfortunately. But this is, I think if you peel back the onion and you debrief, like, where did it all go awry? There's some people that needed to get eradicated, right? Some really bad people that need to. But the unfortunate piece in all of this, whether they're bad or good, good people did get, it was collateral.
I think
humanizing it, it's like if my uncle's a really bad person and I'm a kid, like I probably don't really fully recognize that. But if he gets swacked by a 500-pounder, like you don't know that, but now we've now created a person with sentiment.
And it's also it's hard because you expect to do something against it, and the tools you have that you're used to using, I mean, are they the right ones? Or I mean, I can't blame anybody for Afghanistan was like, you needed a reaction on that. It was like so hilarious. So I think everybody was just saying, okay, they're going to get it now. So. Yep.
Yeah, it's a problem set that I don't have the solution for, but I think now, as I've gotten older and seen it, and you have a little bit more conversations, you take a step back, because it's probably, being a young guy is like, man, I just want to get in the fight. I want to get in the fight and do it. And then you start kind of looking at maybe a little bit bigger picture from a 30 or 40,000 foot view and maybe.
So not, now it's more peace and love.
My neck just hurts now. My neck and back hurt, so I gotta take it easy, So, let's talk a little about today. So you're still in it. head of operations again. Is that your current role?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
What's the normal day in the life of? Is it pretty busy tempo, or is the transition to the F-35 happening? What are the dynamics?
Yeah, we are in the transition phase right now. We got the first four aircraft last September, or last year, and of course had been training out of Arizona Luke Air Force Base for like a couple of years now. It might be around 50% of the pilots are fully committed to F-35 now, and the other half is F-16. So it's like it's all moving away and away from F-16, and we're gonna sell some jets to Argentina, in fact. So
interesting.
Yeah, it is. But anyway, it's normal life is still go out, do the training. You have the training program you have to get to, and then do the QIA. And a lot of that is, of course, with a focus going east to the Baltics and stuff. So
QIA, break that down for me.
Quick reaction alert.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So we have that, you know. Yeah.
How... With other NATO nations sitting there, I guess we can go this. Like, obviously, you got a piece of the sky that you're responsible for. Should Russia send something westbound to go intercept?
It's more like doing the air policing. You know,
okay.
Show presence. It could be assisting civilian aircraft having problems. It's the right main gear that's blown, or it could be just patrolling. And of course, we have to do some, when we have aircraft getting close to Danish airspace that is not squawking, is not communicating, and we'll go there and take a look at it and see what it is.
Okay.
And then, of course, Russia got some a part of. Or it's not that it's used there. They are engaged elsewhere, although other places. But they still fly in the Baltics, and we often go out there and follow them around when they are close to our borders and stuff. So, but it's not for us flying there. It's not like. Things have changed that much. I think it's, and we are not there to escalate anything. So we are there to show them we know that you are here. We know what you're doing, and if they are waving, we are waving back. Sometimes you may get a finger instead, but again, that's life. But so it's fairly calm and fairly. Normal, I guess. Maybe we saw a big drop in the beginning of the 90s of Russian activities there, right after it all crumbled. But then it's like, I think it's fairly normal what we see when we do the reaction alerts, scrambles into the eastern part of our territory.
Yeah, I know it happens for us out over Alaska on a fairly routine basis. Probably the news is a little bit more dramatic, the flanker hitting the drone.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Just a little bit more aggression down that way. But I also think, too, like looking at it, I don't know any fighter pilot that in the right mind would want to hit another aircraft. So I think that probably some shenanigans or poor airmanship.
Yeah. Yeah, or whatever it is. And sometimes, I don't know about their navigational skills or their how precise are their platforms and stuff. So if they get a little bit too close to a border or something, is that on purpose, or is it just like the aircraft sucks and the pilots haven't flown for 2 months or something? So
that's...
It's like
I think that's very about like anyone if going and sitting in one, you know, we have like out of the petting zoo.
Yeah.
I mean, the ergonomics of those things are horrendous.
I got a backseat ride in a MiG-29 once.
Horrible. How was that?
It was horrible. Right. I mean, you're sitting like... I would be glad that it was not able to air refuel and only had like, you know, flying time for 40 minutes or something like that. And it was like, I don't think they had any HOTAS hands on throttle and stick. It was like you had to move your hands all the time to flip switches some other places in the cockpit. So
I don't know if this story is true or not. I was flying with a guy recently, and he was saying, I think the Russian Knights, they first... Maybe they went to the Abbotsford Air Show out in Canada, but they came across the U.S. This is the early 90s. Yeah. And he was talking, they picked some F-15s, picked them up off the coast, and were escorting them in. But as they started their descent, when they're back at idle, like their motors would flame out. They would just watch them restarting their motors all the way down. So when you talk about like the ergonomics, they've always lagged with like engine technology is the winner, right? So if you can figure out engine technology, you win. But, I thought that was kind of humorous.
I think my impression is like it's purely a engineer project making that aircraft. They don't have any pilots coming in saying, "Hey, it would be nice to have things settle up like this."
Well, we've gotten better with that. There's still things that pop up with updates and things like, "Why would you do that?" Like that, no pilot in the right mind would ever use that feature or need that feature. But again, you're probably right. It's like, go build this plane. They built the plane and then gave it to the pilots, telling them to figure it out. Yeah. What's your take on? I've been pretty vocal about this. I think Ukraine getting F-16s. There's a lot of complexities that go along with it. And I was like, if you just the training challenges of going from a Soviet designed aircraft to a Western designed aircraft, I think there are going to be significant hurdles with that. You're operating in a very complex and dynamic environment with double digit SAMs, etc. With a fourth-gen aircraft, so there's complexities with that. But I was like, even just the logistics and the supply chain, just think about like our maintainers that make all this stuff happen. That takes years and years of experience and expertise of turning wrenches, soldering, all the above that you just, I don't think you can learn.
Yeah, wasn't it like, was it Churchill saying it takes like 10 days to get rid of a capacity, but it takes like 10 years to rebuild again. So of course it will take time and training. So, I mean, it's just a fact of life, I guess.
Yeah. I think I haven't heard that quote, but I think that's right. I mean, it's a decade. Give a decade, you build enough capacity, you build enough expertise and depth of knowledge in each respective field that, all right, now you can go out there and deploy. Because an instructor pilot in a MiG-29 jumping over to an F-16, there's a lot to learn before you can actually be a sound instructor when it comes to the tactics and things like that, I think.
Yeah, especially if you got the different philosophy on tactics. So,
yeah, if you're going from a flight lead that, hey, here's the ROEs, here's the commander's intent, go out and conquer, to very close controlled turn left, turn right, do this, do that. That's a big mind shift.
Yeah, it is.
For sure. So, interesting. Well, as we wrap up here, I always like to ask my guests, if you found a 15, 16-year-old Matt walking down the street, is there any advice you would give him? Tell him to do something different? Sage advice?
No. I think it went pretty good.
Yeah, I'd say so. And then... are you going to keep flying the Mighty Viper as long as they let you, or what's the plan?
Yeah, I hope to fly the Viper until we ship the last one off to Argentina.
Okay. It's pretty solid. Well, Matt, thank you for taking the time today. It was great chatting with you. Great getting to know you a little bit. And if you're willing to hang around for a There I Was story, we'll get into that next.
It was a pleasure.
The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns, Gear, and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgearin.com/rain.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.